White people spend a lot of time worrying about poor people. It takes up a pretty significant portion of their day. They feel guilty and sad that poor people shop at Walmart instead of Whole Foods. They vote Republican instead of Democratic. That they go to community college or get a job instead of studying art in college. It is a poorly kept secret that deep down white people believe that if given money and education, all poor people would be exactly like them.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, we'll hear a reading by Christian Lander, who started a blog called Stuff White People Like. The stuff included yoga, free trade coffee, and, yes, NPR. Stuff White People Like was intended to make fun of stereotypes and start conversations about racial identity. It was also pretty funny. At its peak, Stuff White People Like got hundreds of thousands of hits a day. Christian Lander's new book, based on his blog, is called Stuff White People Like, A Definitive Guide to the Unique Taste of Millions. This reading was recorded in July 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell the story of how this all happened and how I ended up here and sort of run through a little bit. And then I have some readings for you guys that I've chosen specifically, I think, for D.C., so this site, my friend Miles and I, we both grew up in Toronto, Canada, in this pretty much the same neighborhood. Miles is Filipino and I'm white, in case you didn't notice. And we were talking about the TV show The Wire, which I'm guessing is near and dear to people around here. And we both huge, huge fans of the show. We absolutely love it. And Miles said that he didn't trust any white person who didn't watch the show. Because Miles had this belief that they didn't know what was going on in the streets. I'm like, Miles, you're from the same neighborhood as I am in Toronto. It doesn't – but anyways. So we started asking ourselves, like, well, what are white people doing instead of watching The Wire? Because they have to be doing something, right? And we came back with these ideas. Going to plays. Getting divorced. Going to therapy. And I was like, okay, this is hilarious. This is so funny. This is great. So – I went to WordPress, the free blogging software that many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, and I typed in stuffwhitepeoplelike.wordpress.com, and I started writing. And I never in a million years expected more than 5 people to read it. I did it for me, I did it for Miles, and I did it for a few of my friends. And then as I was working on it, my friend Sean, who's in design school in Victoria, British Columbia, his focus was on magazine and book layout, and he needed a final project. And I said, well, how about we do this Stuff White People Like site as your book? I'll just write really, really fast. I'll get to 50 entries as soon as possible. And my wife will take the pictures, and they're on a Nikon SLR, so they'll be really high quality, and everything will be perfect. And he was like, oh, awesome. So he started asking around Victoria print shops about how much it would cost to do a run of 300. And we were sort of thinking, all right, it'll be a tiny little book. It'll be a gift to our friends and family for the rest of ours and their lives every single year. And that was the plan. And so at around 25 or 20 entries, I was like, okay, this is actually pretty funny. I'm going to send it to all of my friends. And I only have about 20 friends. I'm going to be perfectly, or at least 20 friends that I would bother with one of my internet projects. So I sent it to them. And then next thing I knew, they sent it to their friends. And their friend, you know, the Wayne's World and the other movie before. And their friends and their friends. And next thing I know, someone says, your blog's on Good Magazine's blog. I'm like, what? And I check. There it is. Good Magazine. Al Gore's son's magazine's blog for the magazine. There it is. And that same day, it's on Comedy Central's blog. And I can't believe this. I'm like, how did this even happen? And then it starts getting crazier and crazier. It kept getting bigger and bigger. And then it was on the New York Times blog. And it was in Andrew Sullivan's blog. And next thing I know, someone from the LA Times is like, we want to do a story about you. And I cannot believe it. Every day, I'm like, this cannot get any crazier. And then the literary agents get in touch with me. And I have to tell Sean, whoa, 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 don't register this title and publish it. So to this day, I think I still owe Sean a beer because I took away his final project. I think he got an A on whatever it is that he did, but I had to pull it back. And before I knew it, there it was. It was big enough that literary agents were calling and there was a book deal in place. So what I want to talk about now is where this concept came from. Not necessarily where white people came from. The answer is Europe, if you're... where the title came from. One of the things people always want to tell me when they see the title and they see the blog is, shouldn't this actually be called Stuff Yuppies Like? Or Stuff Upper Middle Class Left Wing Liberals Like? And I mean, yeah, but then it's not funny, right? Like, It takes away one of my favorite things of the site. One of my favorite things of the site is when someone writes in and says, well, you know, I'm white, but I don't like sushi or expensive sandwiches, so I guess I'm not white, and I'm really offended at this. And it is my favorite thing because I can say back to them, I can say, so when someone makes a broad generalization about your race that doesn't apply to you, you find it offensive. I think there's a few people who might be able to relate. And so I'm never changing the title, ever. So where it came from, like I said before, I grew up in Toronto, Canada, in downtown Toronto, and my neighborhood was called Riverdale. My dad bought a house there in the late 1970s, and when he did, his friends were sort of like, what are you doing moving to this neighborhood? It's still working class. And it was never really a rough neighborhood, but it was definitely working class, and it was in East Chinatown, so there were a lot of Chinese immigrants and working class people. And as I got older, I noticed that all of the working class people of my neighborhood were pushed out entirely. And so by the time I got to high school, everyone there, and my father was a high school teacher, he's retired now, everyone there was upper, middle class, left-wing liberal. And they were the only white people left. And it wasn't just my neighborhood this was happening. It was every single neighborhood in Toronto. So when Miles and I started the site Stuff White People Like, these were the only type of white people we know. I mean, again, obviously I'm one of them. But like these were the only type that we grew up with. There was no right-wing voice, and there was no working classness. They'd all been pushed out to the suburbs. And we were the super snobby city kids. Like, I still don't know where Toronto suburbs are on a map. Like, I cannot point them out. If a streetcar doesn't run there, I don't know where it is. And so these were the only type of white people. So that's where this idea came from in terms of why we named it Stuff White People Like. And then I think my inspiration for writing came from graduate school. So for anyone here who's considering a PhD in the arts, please talk to me. I have some advice for you that you may not want to hear. So I did a master's degree in film at the University of Arizona. I had a fantastic time. I worked really, really hard in my undergrad, and the master's degree at Arizona allowed me to cram an undergrad experience into a two-year master's degree. I think I got dumber. And anyways, from there, I then went into a PhD program at Indiana University in literature and film. And graduate school was a really, really interesting experience in that, so my whole life I'd grown up, obviously, left-wing liberal. I mean, I'm Canadian. I didn't really have a choice. And I got to graduate school, and I noticed that everyone obviously shared the same views as I did, but they shared them to an extreme that they wouldn't listen to anything else. And it really started to bother me. Not that I was – and the example I have is, so Ann Coulter came to IU's campus. Wait, people here don't like Ann Coulter. I think I'm in the wrong bookstore. No. So while I'm no fan of what she has to say, a bunch of students from my program showed up to her speech to yell and make all sorts of noise and try and shut the whole thing down. And I was so unbelievably annoyed by this. I was like, well, look, let her talk. You know, I mean, just because you don't agree with her and she's wrong doesn't mean she's... I'm sorry, I couldn't even pretend the free speech myth any farther than that. But doesn't mean she shouldn't be allowed to speak. And I just kept noticing that everyone in graduate school, in spite of having the tag of being open-minded, and they would use the tag of open-minded because they would support things like open borders, gay marriage, all these things are great. It doesn't mean you're open-minded. It means you support these progressive issues. It doesn't mean you're open-minded. And it started to drive me nuts until I eventually dropped out and moved to Los Angeles. Kind of like the most anti-grad school place you can possibly move. But I was so fed up with this belief and this absolute, everyone thought exactly the same, but at the same time, everyone believed that they were 100% entirely unique. I was like, no, but you all think the same, you like the same stuff, and you make everybody else feel bad for not liking the same stuff. And so I had this in me, this sort of rage, or being a disaffected liberal, I suppose, that led to a lot of what came out of this book. And so I moved to Los Angeles, got as far away from grad school as I could. I didn't read a book for like 3 months. Sorry. All I read was celebrity blogs and like and Us magazine, and it was fantastic. And so I got a job at an interactive agency in Culver City called Schematic, and I worked as an associate manager of corporate communications. And what that meant was I would write proposals, I would write case studies, I would just do the writing for the company, and it was certainly not the worst job in the world. And that's where I was working when I started this up with Miles. That's where we were having the IM conversation. I did get to quit the job. I didn't expect applause from that because I'm sure most of you hate me for being able to say that. I would hate me too, to be perfectly honest. So the next question is, so with all of this that's happened, why has it been so successful? And when I'm left to think about why the blog succeeded, I think, and especially this topic and this idea, it's been done before. And people have been very, very happy to point that out to me, that this has been done before. So David Brooks' Bobo in Paradise, Martin Mull's A History of White People in America. Fortunately, I haven't read or seen either of them because I don't want to be accused of stealing from them. And when this is all over and said and done, I'll check those out. But something was different about this than what was done in the past. And one of the things I think that worked in favor of it was this whole idea of the list and the idea of doing it as a list of stuff, you know, in quotation marks. And I think what made that really interesting in terms of the growth of the blog was that it made it really easy for people to forward on, that it wasn't this one long essay or these small essays. They'd either directly applied to you or directly applied to someone you probably knew. And people would forward it on. And what would happen is people would read the rest of the site and then forward it on again. And the extra thing with the list is it's open-ended. This hasn't ended yet. And everyone, I'm sure most people here, have an idea for something that belongs in the list that I haven't done yet. And that has led to a whole lot of conversation and people just talking about what's missing from this list. And then the other thing that happened that was interesting was there were a lot of spin-off blogs. I'm not sure if you've heard of any of them. There are a lot. So the first one I knew was Stuff Educated Black People Like, then Stuff Asians Like, Stuff Brown People Like, Stuff Latinos Like, Stuff Gay People Like, Stuff Gay Parents Like. Someone started one called Stuff Hill People Like, specifically for Washington, D.C. And they just kept going on and on, and there's one that I love that I have to point out. It's called White Stuff People Like. And it lists things like cocaine and sugar and plaster. You know what I mean? It's like that's by far my favorite spin-off blog. But so anyway, so these spin-off blogs had started because the concept was so simple. Take your race or specific group, find a bunch of stuff that everyone likes, and approach it from, and this is the important part, a non-hateful way. And I think that was one of the big things throughout the book, throughout the whole writing thing, that none of this is meant to incite hatred against white people. And I mean, that's pretty obvious to everyone who reads it. But people can take this in very different, very negative directions to try and reinforce negative stereotypes. And so, for example, WordPress does this amazing thing where it'll tell you what sites are linking to yours. And early on, I saw that the site was linked to by a white supremacist group. They're called Stormfront. And I could not believe it. And here's the weird thing. I'd heard of them before. Now, this is what. So when I was 16 years old, I used to play this video game called Tony La Russa Baseball. I loved this game. And it was made by a company called Stormfront Studios. So I typed Stormfront into Google, and what I got back was a white supremacist site. I couldn't believe it, and here they are again 10 years later. And they took it in, of course, the horrible wrong direction. And it was really interesting. So the whole idea of taking this non-hateful view on race and sort of breaking it down to the banal things of stuff like shorts and New Balance shoes. My pair is in my hotel room. Was sort of new, and people were taking it on, and it was just driving more people to come back to look at my site, and I couldn't believe it. And I was shocked. I still am shocked. And so that was one reason. Now, the second reason, one of the key components of yuppies is the U part. What does that stand for? Urban. Urban. And what I found that was interesting was it young urban professionals, and I guess pies. I don't know what the extra part is. Because they're into that. So what I'd found by going to graduate school and sort of living in all these different parts of the U.S. was that these people weren't just in urban centers. They were in college towns, and they were hating everyone around them. Big component of getting your PhD in the arts. And so it was sort of a new spin on it. And I think the one thing I identified throughout here that I think the book goes after as a theme that I'm sure most of you recognize is the theme of competition and about being ranked as a white person. And I think what's really different about this generation of people is that we still have that keeping up with the Joneses mentality, you know, that our parents or grandparents had. But instead of sort of being, well, my car is bigger, my house is bigger, the pursuit is, well, I'm more authentic, I'm more carbon neutral. But the competition is still there, and it's an inherent competition to prove that you're better than your peers. And that's what comes through in all of this. And I think that what I was just sort of going after and what I'd recognized was the change, that it wasn't about material wealth anymore, because quite frankly, the white people I write about don't have to worry about money anymore. I mean, yeah, you can't get a house on the beach, but you can still pay rent. And that's really what I was going after, and that, I think, is what really struck a chord. And of course, it was me going after myself. I mean, I'm as bad as anybody on this subject. If you want to find out, just ask me about music. But I was noticing all this in myself, and it was... Self-loathing isn't the word I'd go after, but I used this blog and this book as a chance to really attack the contradictions and the pretentiousness that I was sort of recognizing I was guilty of. So those are my two guesses why it's successful. Also, it's kind of funny. That's the last one I can add in, and everything else has been really just a giant surprise to me, and I'm so lucky for it. I'm going to do a couple readings here that I think are particular for DC. And then I'm really excited about the question and answer period. It's always the most fun, and I promise you'll enjoy it. So I hope these are applicable. I'll see if you agree with me. The first one is number 16, Gifted Children. Every time I do one of these signings, I want to ask everyone who is a gifted child to raise their hand. But I won't do it. But I won't do it for fear of shaming everyone. But... It is particularly funny. So I'm just going to read through a couple of these. I hope you enjoy them, and I certainly do. White people love gifted children. Do you know why? Because an astounding 100% of their children are gifted. Isn't that amazing? I'm pretty sure the last non-gifted child was born in 1962 in Reseda, California. Since then, it's been a pretty sweet run. Side note, I picked Reseda, California because of the Karate Kid. That's where the Karate Kid was from. But his girlfriend was from Encino. She was like rich and stuff. All right. The way it works is that white kids who are actually smart are quickly identified as gifted and take special classes and eventually end up in college and then law school or medical school. But wait. Aren't there white people who aren't doctors and lawyers? Or even all that smart? Well, this is another one of those awesome white person win-win situations. If white kids get crappy grades and can't seem to ever do anything right in school, they're still gifted. How, you ask? They're just too smart for school. They're too creative, too advanced to care about the trivial minutiae of the day-to-day operations of school. Eventually, they'll show their creativity in elaborate constructions of bongs and intimate knowledge of different kinds of mushrooms and hash. This knowledge is important to you if you ever find yourself needing to gain the acceptance of white people. If you see their kids playing peacefully, say, oh, they seem very focused. Are they in a gifted program? At which point the parents will say yes. Or if the kid is lighting a dog on fire while screaming at his or her mother, you say, my, he or she's creative. Are they gifted? To which the parent will reply, oh yes, he's just too creative and smart for school. We just don't know what to do. Either situation will put a white person in a better mood and make them like you more. Warning, never, under any circumstances, imply that their child is less than a genius. The idea that something could come from them and have less than greatness is too much for them to bear. So I thought that was applicable for DC. There seem to be a few gifted people running around here. The next one I had, and this was, it's been fun. I've only been in DC for a day, and it's been really fun to walk around and see there are an awful lot of places here dedicated to post number 18, awareness. An interesting fact about white people is that they firmly believe all of the world's problems can be solved through awareness. Meaning the process of making other people aware of problems, magically causing someone else, like the government, to fix it. This belief allows them to feel that sweet self-satisfaction without actually having to solve anything or face any difficult challenges, because the only challenge of raising awareness is getting the attention of people who are currently unaware. What makes this even more appealing for white people is you can raise awareness through expensive dinners, parties, marathons, t-shirts, fashion shows, concerts, and bracelets. In other words, white people just have to keep doing stuff they like, except that now they can feel better about making a difference. Raising awareness is also awesome, because once you raise awareness to an acceptable, though arbitrary level, you can just kick back and say, bam, did my part, now it's your turn, fix it. So to summarize, you get all the benefits of helping, self-satisfaction, telling other people, but no need for difficult decisions or the ensuing criticism. How do you criticize awareness? Once again, white people find a way to score that sweet double victory. Popular things to be aware of include the environment, diseases like cancer and AIDS, Africa, poverty, anorexia, homophobia, middle school field hockey / lacrosse teams, drug rehab, and political prisoners. growing up where I did, this is one of my favorite ones in the book, and I'm guessing a few people here are guilty of this one. Number 22, having two last names. In recent years, white people have loved giving their children two last names. This is a direct result of white women thinking it's sexist and outdated to take their husband's name. It is also sexist that a child would carry the name of only one parent, especially since the unnamed parent is the one who carried the child for 9 months. The only logical solution is to give the kid a split last name. White people can't get enough of it. As a result, we have children growing up named Elijah Sadler Brown. While it's true that many Spanish-speaking cultures do this, oftentimes their names are crazy long, but are shortened into sweet one-word nicknames like Pele. Also, there is historical precedent. As this is a recent phenomenon, we have yet to see what happens when one split-name person marries another split-name person. Does the kid end up with four last names? There are some concerns that collegiate lacrosse and soccer jerseys are going to look pretty strange in the next few years. This is a legitimate question. I really do want to know what's going to happen when, like, because no one's given up a name, and there's going to be four of them, and those jerseys are going to start here and, like, end up here. All right. This is the last one from the book, and this is a personal favorite because this was the one I think that I personally attacked myself the most. Number 62, knowing what's best for poor people. White people spend a lot of time worrying about poor people. It takes up a pretty significant portion of their day. They feel guilty and sad that poor people shop at Walmart instead of Whole Foods, and they vote Republican instead of Democratic, that they go to community college or get a job instead of studying art in college. It is a poorly kept secret that deep down white people believe that if given money and education, all poor people would be exactly like them. In fact, the only reason that poor people make the choices they do is because they've not been given the means to make the right choices and care about the right things. A great way to make white people feel good is to tell them about situations where poor people changed how they were doing things because they were given the whiter option. Back in my old town, people used to shop at Walmart, and this nonprofit organization came in, set up a special farmers co-op so we could buy more local products, and within 2 weeks, the Walmart shut down, and we elected our first Democratic representative in 40 years. White people will first ask, which nonprofit, and are they hiring? They will also be so filled with euphoria that they will invite you to more parties so you can tell the story to their friends. Warning, it is essential that you make it clear to poor people that you make it clear that poor people do not make decisions based on free will. To suggest anything to the contrary could crush white people and their hope for the future. So, I have one last one. This is the most recent. This is not in the book, so this is like an exclusive. So I figured Washington D.C. I have an entry on unpaid internships, and I feel like there's a battle between Washington, D.C. and New York for the most unpaid internships in the United States, with the combined with the highest rents. It's a fantastic situation. So if there's a ton of grammar and typos in this, it's because it came straight off the website, and I'm awful at editing my own stuff. Fortunately, my entire audience is more than happy to point out every single grammar mistake I've ever made in the entire site, and has offered to be my copy editor for free, just for the joy of correcting my mistakes. Fantastic. I do have a post on the site about grammar, about how white people will copy edit for free. It doesn't matter what it is. Just be like, can you look this over for me? And they'll do it and they'll be so happy. It's like a gift to them. You know what I mean? So, unpaid internships. I think this is number 105. In most of the world, when a person works long hours without pay, it's referred to as slavery or forced labor. For white people, this process is referred to as an internship, and is considered an essential stage of white development. The concept of working for little or no money underneath a superior has been around for centuries in the form of apprenticeship programs. Young people, eager to learn a trade, would spend time working under a master craftsman to learn a skill that would eventually lead to an increase in material wealth. Using this logic, you would assume that the most sought-after internships would be in areas that lead to the greatest financial reward. Young white people, however, prefer internships that put them on the path for careers that will generally result in a decrease of the material wealth accumulated by their parents. For example, if you were to present a white 19-year-old with the choice of spending the summer earning $15 an hour as a plumber's apprentice or making $0 answering phones at a production company, they will always choose the latter. In fact, the only way to get the white person to choose the plumbing option would be to convince them that it was leading towards some sort of end-of-summer pipe art installation. White people view the internship as their foot into the door of such high-profile, low-paying career fields as journalism, film, politics, art, nonprofits, and anything associated with a museum. Any white person who takes an internship outside of these industries is either the wrong type of white person or a law student. There are no exceptions. If all goes according to plan, an internship will end with an offer of a job that pays $24,000 a year and will consist entirely of the same tasks they were recently doing for free. In fact, the transition to full-time status results in the addition of only one new responsibility: feeling superior to the new interns. When all is said and done, the internship process serves the white community in many ways. First, it helps train the next generation of freelance writers, museum curators, and director's assistants. But more importantly, internships teach white children how to complain about being poor. So when a white person tells you about their unpaid internship at the New Yorker, it's not a good idea to point out how the cost of rent and food will essentially mean they're paying their employer for the right to make photocopies. Instead, it's best to say, you earned it. They will not get the joke.
I've got a question that I'm sure you're asked pretty often, but so you get all of these ideas from all these people saying, I think this would be great, this would be great, this would be great. How do you sort through them and decide what exactly you want to write about? Is it something that you yourself have seen or can relate to? Or do you go survey your friends and say, hey, would this be funny?
It's a weird thing. I think the reason that the blog took off and the book is popular is because I have to go after myself here. You know what I mean? I put myself out there and I'm willing to admit how ridiculous I am in most of this stuff. And so it's weird. It's like, remember there's that judge, I'm sure one of you can tell me who it was, who's on the obscenity trial, who said, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it.
Right.
I'm sure there's a law student in here who can tell me exactly which one that was. Which one? Potter. Supreme Court Justice. This is fantastic. It's like Wikipedia without a computer. But you just know it when you see it, and it's hard to say. So you have to I think back of the people I went to graduate school with and the people I went to undergrad with, and you just know. I mean, farmers markets are the best place for them, like, converged into one spot. So it's just like, if someone there does it, it makes the list. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. It's pretty easy.
Hi, we're from Britain.
Oh.
Just wondering whether you're aware of how well this has travelled.
Actually,
and whether there's a, I mean, there are lots of things that are very familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
But just whether you've had much response from across the pond.
Yeah, actually.
You all here back there?
A question about the international appeal of white people. It's actually hilarious. There is going to be confirmed a Dutch edition of the book. I cannot wait to see the title. Like, and you know, it's gonna be like J's and double O's everywhere. It's gonna be awesome. And then they have not. There's interest in doing a UK version or UK edition of the book. They might be a little. I might have to reword the whole thing on the idea of soccer versus actual soccer. Because there is an important difference. But it's been really funny the internet is crazy. Like, I've done radio interviews for Italy and Norway and a lot in Australia. Because Australia has a lot of white people. And a lot of the kind that are talked about in the book. Because, you know, Australia and Canada are very similar in the histories of the countries. And, except that we didn't, you know, come from criminals. And I stand by that call. Fight any Australian in here. Well, no, I won't. They'll win. Sorry. And so it's been insane just to see there has been a lot of international people. Like, people from Norway are requesting the book, and Sweden and Denmark. And so there has been an international interest. Croatia, Argentina. I wasn't expecting any of this. I was like, really? So there has been, I no way ever expected there to be an international appeal. I guess white people are everywhere. Just gotta look for him.
So I'm an intern. I get paid, and I'm not a Republican. So yeah.
Where the hell do you work?
Center for American Progress.
Did everyone who's looking for an internship that pays hear that?
But I mean, we had a huge discussion in the office like about this before it came. I'm actually on assignment right now, and so I guess I'm just gonna say.
So wait, not only do you have a paid internship, but you're getting paid for this?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I complained about it.
Can I get Natalie?
Not to like, I'm gonna ask like maybe some slightly serious question
Okay.
amongst the discussion. what would you say to critics that would say that maybe you're kind of perpetuating this snobby mentality?
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I can't – snobs have been around forever, and they're going to be around forever, and I can't fix it, you know? And so what I was hoping that the book would do and the blog would do was just to point out to everyone who is a snob is to recognize it. I mean, that's step one, right? I don't know what the 12 steps are, but awareness, there you go. You can sit back down now. felt like such a jerk. But I mean, I'm a humor writer here. I'm not a performance artist. And the best thing I can do is sort of point out to everyone who is a snob to say, you know what? Does it really matter at the end of the day that this guy likes you too? Which is a crime in my book. I'm sorry. But just pointing it out, it's like, does this really matter? Why are you so invested in it? Because it's part of snobbery, especially for our generation. Like, what do we have left? You know what I mean? Like, we can't rebel against our parents. Our parents, like, encourage every single thing we do. It's like, oh, you want to be an anarchist now? That's fantastic. I've got plenty of beer bottles and gasoline in the basement. Let's burn some shit. Let's do it. So what do we have so little to rebel against that you grasp onto anything with authenticity. You know what I mean? And music's about as authentic as we can get on the snobbery side. And so we're just grabbing for anything we can with authenticity. And so I'm hoping to sort of point out, I mean, it's for myself as well, to say, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that this guy doesn't know who Cut Copy is, right? Like, it doesn't matter.
Lights of Music is great.
It's fantastic, but it doesn't matter. That's what I'm trying to point out, is that we're spending so much time and energy, you know what I mean, in this contest that really goes nowhere. And that's the best I can do with it.
Cool. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me. It was great. That was so much fun.
Really wonderful.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.